From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with this week's bad newspaper news. The New York Times put in place a 5% pay cut. The Boston Globe is hanging by a thread. Even the satirical weekly The Onion wasn't immune. It announced it was shutting down its West Coast print editions. And Warren Buffett said he would not buy a newspaper company at any price. Also this week, the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation held a hearing on the future of journalism. Committee Chairman John Kerry kicked it off.
Welcome all to a brave new world. This hearing is genuinely geared to examine, to understand what we don't know, to try to figure out from various people in these fields of expertise of new media and the existing media of where we're going.
All righty. The senators confirmed the importance of the Fourth Estate and the crisis it faces. Senator Ben Cardin stepped up to the mic with a bill that would extend nonprofit status to newspapers.
I introduced the Newspaper Revitalization Act. My legislation uses the 501c3 model, similar to what a church would use or what an educational institution would use, a public broadcasting, and other nonprofits.
Senator Cardin assured the committee that his plan was not a bailout, just a little boost for the industry. But it came with a few strings attached. Under this bill, news organizations would no longer be able to endorse political candidates. That seems a little problematic. But don't worry, because
it was filed in an effort to create a national debate as to how we can preserve our local news operations.
In other words, the bill has as good a chance of passage as the newspaper industry has of becoming a hot place to invest your money. Then David Simon, former Baltimore Sun reporter and creator of the HBO series The Wire, took a turn at the mic.
From the captains of the newspaper industry, you may hear a certain martyrology, a claim that they were heroically serving democracy only to be undone by a cataclysmic shift in technology. From those speaking on behalf of new media, weblogs, and that which goes Twitter, you will be treated to assurances that American journalism has a perfectly fine future online and that a great democratization is taking place. Well, a plague on both their houses.
It was a cinematic smackdown.
High-end journalism is dying in America, and unless a new economic model is achieved, it will not be reborn on the web or anywhere else. The internet is a marvelous tool, and clearly it is the information delivery system of our future, but thus far it does not deliver much first-generation reporting. Instead, it leeches that reporting from mainstream news publications, whereupon aggregating websites and bloggers contribute little more than repetition, commentary, and froth.
Sitting next to Simon was the very model of an aggregating blogger, Arianna Huffington.
Actually, if you look at, for example, Voices of San Diego, which is a not-for-profit site that is exposing precisely what you're talking about, local corruption, and actually having real impact investigative journalism. That is happening around the country.
The day I run into a Huffington Post reporter at a Baltimore zoning board hearing is the day that I will be confident that we've actually reached some sort of equilibrium. You know, the next 10 or 15 years in this country are going to be a halcyon era for state and local political corruption. It is going to be one of the great times to be a corrupt politician, right?
Then Simon and a newspaper publisher accused Google of essentially stealing their intellectual property. But Google's Marissa Meyer said Google wasn't stealing. It was helping news outlets get the word out.
All newspapers, all publishers right now can opt out of aggregation. There are standard industry practices, files that you can put in place that say, please don't collect my content. It is true, though, that most newspapers, in fact, prefer the distribution. The distribution is better for them. It's also better for users.
Huffington agreed.
In fact, we're getting hundreds of requests every week from newspapers to link to them. And I'm sure they love being linked to from Google because it drives a lot of traffic.
It's a product. It's created by somebody.
That's John Kerry.
It's an intellectual property, which we recognize as having a value, correct?
Absolutely.
Why do they not have a right? Why is it antiquated to believe they have a right to be paid for their product?
No. The fact that they wish that was the case is not antiquated. The fact that it cannot happen is antiquated because that's not how people are consuming news.
Huffington pointed to Times Select, the now defunct New York Times plan to put some content behind a paywall, as proof that news wants to be free. Not so, says David Simon.
What it showed was that the Times acting alone, without the Washington Post, without other competitors, could not go it alone.
Mr. Simon's exactly right. This horse is out of the barn.
Jim Maroney is the publisher of the Dallas Morning News.
To try to bring it back one website at a time, one daily newspaper website at a time, will not work. If the Dallas Morning News today put up a paid wall over its content, people would go to the Fort Worth Star-Telegram.
The solution, argued Maroney, David Simon, and Alberto Ibarguen, president of the Knight Foundation, is for newspapers to act in unison, whether that means retreating altogether behind a paywall or collectively negotiating with the likes of Google News. Problem is, it's kind of illegal. Antitrust laws bar competitors from discussing pricing and payment schemes. Maroney challenged Congress to change the law.
Congress should act quickly on legislation providing a limited antitrust exemption that will allow newspapers some breathing room to share ideas and jointly explore innovative business models.
What an image. Media honchos conspiring in a smoke-filled room. Just the sort of thing to send thrills up the legs of paranoid media haters. So we called Jim Maroney of the Dallas Morning News and asked him whether his proposed exemption was really in the public's interest or just that of newspaper publishers.
Congress decided in the 1970 Failing Newspaper Act that there was a public benefit to maintaining two newspapers in one town as opposed to only one. I'm confident that that same idea would extend to having one newspaper in a town instead of zero newspapers in a town.
Another charge that was aimed at you at the panel mm-hmm. was that you're impervious to updating or adapting, that you're clinging to an old business model and an old paper medium and ignoring the march of time.
DallasNews.com, if we're doing 50 million page views a month and 6 million unique visitors, we're not putting up PDF pages of our newspaper. We are using the same sophisticated technology that's driving the whole internet ecosystem. So this charge that we're not investing millions and millions of dollars in our websites and that we're somehow clinging to the past is wrong. The problem is I invest $30 million a year in news gathering resources, the Dallas Morning News. I don't do $30 million of revenue through DallasNews.com in a given year. So if I quit publishing the newspaper tomorrow and went purely digital, what's going to have to go is a great number of the professional journalists that I employ today. We had a 1% margin in the first quarter for our three operating companies, and our total company, including corporate overhead, lost money. I'm not protecting big margins, and I'm not lining the pockets of some executive somewhere with big bonuses. We're trying to survive.
I think you anticipated my next question. David Simon, who is the creator of The Wire, was in the hearing room with you, and he agreed that newspapers need to reap some financial benefit from their online content. But he also argued that unreasonable executive pay, media concentration that led to huge newspaper chains and created a demand for a profit margin much higher than there used to be. Just general greed has led to a decline of journalism. And this is long before Craigslist decimated the classifieds.
Well, I guess I can only say this. If the newspaper companies that may fit David's paradigm about what they did haven't learned something from the predicament in which they find themselves, then we are really in trouble. I believe that the newspaper companies that perhaps made those kinds of choices in the past will look up and recognize that what has sustained and caused their brand to be durable is the professionally produced journalism that they have, and to continue to diminish that scale of resource is frankly a bad business decision, regardless of whether you think it's a public good or not.
Now, you testified about your negotiations with Amazon regarding the Kindle electronic reader. Could you tell us about that?
Somebody was bringing up the Kindle as the solution we should all be focused on. And I love the Kindle. I read books on it all the time. My problem is that after negotiating, the very best deal we could get from Amazon was to split revenues for whatever price we decided to charge. We could get 30% of that money, they get 70%.
Wow.
I could have probably lived with that, but there was another clause in there that they would not give me relief on, and that said that they have the right to relicense my content to any portable device, not just an Amazon-owned device, any portable device. In essence, I was giving them a complete licensing agreement for nothing for all of my content, period. I'm sort of about to give away my future, you know. If Amazon came back, I thought maybe they'd call today and say, you know what, we'll give up on that little clause about the relicensing of your IP. I would have said, okay, you know what, I'll try this thing at 70-30 and see if it works. But nobody called today, as far as I can tell.
Well, I can certainly see how a united newspaper front would come in real handy in dealing with Amazon. Tell me, what was the reaction of the senators in the room? Did you get the sense that this was anything other than a futile exercise?
I was very impressed with all of the senators' comments. What they said out loud and clearly and plainly was that they believed that doing the kind of professional journalism that is to a great degree done by the newspaper newsrooms of this country is absolutely essential and important to a vibrant democracy. If no one had at least provided the forum for the expression of these sentiments and ideas, I would tell you this, we certainly would be farther behind than we are today.
Jim, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the time to have this conversation.
Jim Maroney is the publisher of the Dallas Morning News.
Coming up, the big news on the new big Kindle and the malice of the trolls.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hey, pod people, this is Katya, senior producer of OTM. Finally, for the first time ever, you can get an On the Media t-shirt, a notebook, a refrigerator magnet, a mouse pad, whatever. We got it. If you want it, you can find it by clicking the link on our website, onthemedia.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, Amazon introduced yet another Kindle electronic reader. The Kindle DX is larger than its two predecessors to make it easier to read newspapers and magazines. We don't know if this Kindle will help revive those ailing paper products because Amazon won't reveal Kindle sales figures. We do know that Kindle has sparked new and unprecedented interest in a reading device that is larger than a cell phone but smaller than a laptop, unlike successive earlier generations of e-readers that are piled up in the gadget graveyard. Paul Saffo, technology forecaster and visiting scholar in the Stanford Media X Research Network, says the Kindle has succeeded in part by not pretending to be a book.
It's the Bakelite phenomena. When the first plastic, Bakelite, was invented in 1907, everybody spent their time trying to make it look like wood and tortoiseshell. And it took them about 10 years to realize that it made pretty lousy wooden tortoiseshell. Someone said, let's let plastic be plastic. And then things got interesting. The same thing is happening with computers. The first electronic tablets were attempting to imitate the book. The important thing about the Kindle is that it's more than a device. The Kindle, it's essential that it's got a wonderful screen and a great form factor, but not sufficient. What completed it is that it's connected to a store where you could buy things, and it has built-in connectivity.
You initially said that the Kindle would do to books what the iPod did to music. Now you say that the Kindle is going to do to the magazine what the iPod did to music.
Well, more precisely, what the Kindle's going to do is it's going to break the spine of magazines apart so that you can buy single stories instead of entire issues. In the same way that the iPod allows us to buy more music than ever, we just don't buy the album, we buy the song. But then it opens up opportunities for whole new literary experiences. But it's inconvenient to both sell short stories in the form of a book collection and inconvenient to buy them that way. Well, With an electronic medium like the Kindle or an ebook, you can just sell one story at a time, and you don't have to mess around with putting them into a book.
To me, the Kindle as a device seems almost quaint. A single-use device doesn't seem to be the way that we're headed. I mean, we both know that Apple has been experimenting with a device that's just around the corner that will combine the iPhone, the Kindle, the netbook, and bring us ever closer to that ideal, a customizable, all-purpose portable screen that will bring us virtually anything that we want when we're on the road. I mean, we're already there. Isn't the Kindle really more like the 8-track tape machine? Isn't it, as one writer for PC World said, isn't the Kindle kindling already?
The way to think about it is you have very large devices on your desktop computers. You have medium-sized devices, laptops that you carry in a briefcase. And then there's a gap down to something you hold in your hand, a BlackBerry, an iPhone. It's that gap in the middle that's about to get filled in with a device that's all screen, looks like a tablet, but it's mainly a display device. And yes, indeed, it will do lots more than just be a display device for reading. It'll be a display device for movies. You'll also be able to use it for communications. So while you may not necessarily ever reach a point where you carry only one device in your life, that new class of tablet device is going to do a lot more than just read books from Amazon.
There have been some arguments over the pricing of books on Kindle. Right now, there's pretty much an under $10 limit. Can they play with those prices?
You can absolutely play with the prices. Once the installed base gets bigger, then you've got a super bestseller. You might be able to sell it for more. But this is also where we have the crossover from repurposing old paper-based media in cyberspace on the Kindle, electronic books, to moving into a new environment where you have native-born digital experiences that are sold. You can chase stories down rabbit holes and discover things that otherwise you'd probably be too lazy to look up. And ultimately, I think we'll see a return back to that 1980s vision of stories like spiderwebs.
Are you talking about choose-your-own-adventure kind of stories?
We have never really had an environment where we could create stories with an infinite amount of endings. And now we're getting readers that can do that. We have the software that can do it. I suspect that we're going to see new literary forms that really are infinite.
But this isn't particular to the Kindle, is it? I mean, it's particular to the internet and to cyberspace and that kind of multilateral communication that's possible in real time now. But we don't need a device, a single-use device, to make that possible.
The device does matter because you have to be able to carry that device as a window into the part of your life where you want to slouch back with a book on a beach or lying on the couch with your feet higher than your head. And you can't do that with laptops and their stupid keyboards. You really need this device. So the device is an essential part of the experience.
Some people have criticized the Kindle because basically what you've purchased is locked onto your device. But you don't own the content. You can't lend it to a friend unless you hand over your Kindle.
Nothing new ever comes into our lives without a hidden curse. And all the convenience of having an electronic form comes with that price. And it troubles me greatly. Those of us who remember when we could share books with friends, we'll be bothered by this for the rest of our lives. And a younger generation that grows up with the idea that you buy things and you use it once, and if you want it again, you buy it again, aren't going to be bothered. But I'd also ask yourself, how many times lately have you really borrowed a book from a friend? Or have you really read a book a second time? Or have you asked a friend to loan you a book? Well, for those things that you want to read more than once, you know, buy them in paper.
Do you think that publishing houses should abhor the Kindle or celebrate it?
You know, the only constant is change. An old order is disappearing. It has been long expected, and there are all sorts of new opportunities. So my advice to publishers who I talk to a lot is you really only have one option, and that is to flee into the future just as fast as you can.
Paul, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Paul Saffo is a technology forecaster and a distinguished visiting scholar at the Stanford MediaX Research Network.
Consumers have been willing to agree to certain locks on the books they buy for the Kindle. At this point, most folks seem to be willing to put up with locks on all kind of content, but locks on DVDs are causing a special problem for documentary filmmakers. They have a legal right to use the material on those DVDs under fair use laws, but the Digital Millennium Copyright Act makes it illegal to break the DVD locks. So this week, a group of documentary makers you might know from such films as Super Size Me and Hoop Dreams took their case to the U.S. Copyright Office to ask for an exemption. Gordon Quinn is the artistic director and co-founder of Kartemquin Films, the producer of Hoop Dreams. He says that this fight comes after years of needlessly backing down every time copyright holders threatened lawsuits.
Everybody just got scared and caved in. And so, you know, you couldn't get your work on PBS or on other broadcasters, and you couldn't get insurance for it to cover these kinds of things if something came up. And so the landscape changed from one in which fair use was used a lot to one in which you just pretty much couldn't use it.
But haven't documentarians recovered much of the leeway that they had surrendered over the decades since, let's say, the 1960s?
Yes. That's really important to us. I mean, 5 years ago, Pat Ofterheide at the Center for Social Media and Peter Yazzie at the Washington College of Law came really to our field and said, you guys have got a terrible problem. There's nothing wrong with the law. You don't have to go to Congress. You don't have to go to the court. It's in the law. All you have to do is use it. And we've been pushing back ever since over the last 4 or 5 years.
In essence, you've emboldened other documentarians.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, I was a victim of it too. I mean, in Hoop Dreams, the family sings the boy happy birthday, and we had to license that for $5,000. Today, I would just declare fair use. We didn't ask them to sing it. It's a snippet in our movie. Our movie's not about happy birthday. It's about the relationship between these family members. And it has been amazing because we have really won our rights back. The broadcasters have come on board. Our last 3 or 4 films were broadcast with the fair use claims in them. And in the last couple of years, the insurance companies have gotten on board.
Having asserted those rights, you're stuck with another problem, and one that by the time this airs, you will have testified about in Washington. And that concerns this weird situation where you're allowed in the house but risk arrest unlocking the door. Tell me about encryption and DVDs.
The problem that we have now is that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act has this very weird piece of it, which essentially your analogy is exactly right. It says the mere act of breaking the encryption on a DVD is what's illegal, even if the use to which you're going to put the material is legal. Of course, everyone knows how to break this encryption. You know, you can find an 18-year-old who can break it for you in a minute, but that's not the point. We don't want to have this vulnerability of having broken this strange piece of the law. The Copyright Office has let some exemptions be created, and we are going as documentary filmmakers and saying, look, we would like an exemption just in this narrow circumstance, only in terms of our fair use.
Okay, so maybe I'm listening to this and I go, yeah, okay, so a bunch of documentarians are running around in their turtlenecks and Birkenstocks. What's it to me whether they have access to encrypted DVDs? Why do I care?
Why you care about it as a citizen is in a democracy, you need to be able to talk about things. You need to be able to discuss things. You need to be able to criticize things. And you can't have ownership issues preventing you from having this dialogue. That's why fair use is in the copyright law. It's Article 27 in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. You know, everyone has the right to participate in the culture of their community. I have to be able to say in our film Refrigerator Mothers, when I'm showing women who were blamed for causing their own child's autism, they were told they didn't love their child, you know, completely discredited theory. Well, I have to show that culture and how women were being portrayed and how they were being treated in the 1950s. And as citizens, people have to care that these films are being made and that people, journalists and other people who tell stories, are not being burdened by all of these unnecessary hurdles.
Gordon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gordon Quinn is the artistic director and co-founder of Kartemquin Films. On Wednesday, Time magazine threw its annual Time 100 Gala, a party thrown for the world's most influential people. You'd probably recognize a bunch of names in attendance. Michelle Obama was there, Oprah Winfrey, Barbara Walters, but what about Moot? Moot, real name Christopher Poole, made his way into the gala by more nefarious means than his fellow partygoers. He hacked his way in. Moot runs a website called 4chan, which has been described as the, quote, dark, throbbing adolescent heart of the internet. The 4chan users hacked Time's online poll for the most influential person, putting Moot at the top and arranging it so that the names in the list below him spelled an acrostic for an act we can't mention on the air. More generally, some 4chan users engage in an act called trolling, a kind of catch-all term for the many ways to intentionally harass online communities. Writer Mattathias Schwartz spent some time reporting on trolls and on 4chan last August for the New York Times Magazine. He says that the worst behavior on 4chan comes from one specific part of the site.
Part of 4chan is this subboard called B, and the behavior on B is worse than almost anything I've seen on the internet for a couple of reasons. The first is that everyone is anonymous. The second reason is that B has almost no memory. 4chan doesn't have very much money to spend on servers, so the site erases itself every 2 or 3 days. So it never really is able to study itself or get any smarter. And then when really terrible, awful things are posted to it, they usually disappear before law enforcement might come on the scene and shut them down, though they have done that from time to time.
Okay, I just want to put some of this in perspective. When I was a boy, my idea of a prank was to make a phony phone call in my pre-adolescent high-pitched voice and ask the person who answered the phone if they had Prince Albert in a can. That doesn't seem to be the state of the art in online mischief. Tell me about the state of the art.
Some of the worst involves pulling down your pants and whipping a part of yourself out and then taking a photograph of it held by like a sleeping miner's face with a sign saying, "What's up, B?" and the time and date. That's pretty bad. I wrote about a young man by the name of Mitchell Henderson. He was, I think, 12 or 13. He shot himself in the head with a rifle and then inexplicably became this phenomenon on B. They made up this rumor that he had killed himself because someone had taken his iPod. People prank called his house. Then they made little images with bullet holes in his head and broken iPods on the floor. Someone posted a dramatic reenactment to YouTube where Mitchell lost his iPod and then went and killed himself. The further and further away it got from the actual suicide, the more of them just start to find it incredibly funny. And it got to the point where someone asked on 4chan, "Oh, was Mitchell Henderson even a real person? I didn't realize that."
Why did they do stuff like this?
They do it for fun. They do it for a sense of release. And they do it because when you're looking at someone across a screen hundreds of miles away, you don't have to empathize with them at all. I think it's much easier to just sort of laugh as you watch them melt down.
In your New York Times Magazine piece, I did see various attempts from the people you interviewed to justify their conduct. Something that I suppose if you sewed it all together could maybe represent a troll-deology. Is there a troll-deology or you know, is it just a bunch of juvenile dirtbags poking people in the eye?
There is a troll-deology, and most of the trolls are juvenile dirtbags. The reasons that they say they do it are not always the reasons that they do it. But a justification that's often given is that by inflicting emotional pain on people through the internet, we will teach them to be less sensitive. If they learn that responding to a trolling provokes them, then eventually they'll learn not to respond and will achieve a kind of Zen neutrality. I mean, the motives behind this are really gross And it is pretty evil just from looking at it on the face. But I think it's important to keep in mind, it's impossible to hurt a person through a computer. All you can do is generate words that they will then read. I mean, you can't have a fist pop out and, like, you know, strangle someone.
Were you the victim of any kind of pranks or harassment of any kind?
Yes. After the story came out, there was a thread on 4chan's B-board posting some of my old addresses, suggesting that pizzas might be sent to those addresses. And then someone else chimed in like, oh, let's get the Jew. I want to see the Jew burning. And this is something I could have called the FBI and totally freaked out. But it's really just like a lot of teenage kids talking to each other in basements. So it didn't bother me so much. There were some Korans that wound up being delivered to my home address in Portland, Oregon. And then some folks from the Seventh-day Adventists came to my door to proselytize. They'd heard that I wanted to convert. I'd prepared my mom for incidents like this, and then she greeted them at the door and said, you've been trolled. I'm sorry.
Mattathias, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Freelance writer Mattathias Schwartz wrote about 4chan for the New York Times Magazine.
Coming up, poor little rich guys and the everyman who is Stephen Colbert.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. In the early 90s, cell phone service was so easy to hack that in some places, up to 70% of cell phone traffic was stolen. Service providers turned to police to trace those illegal calls by using pings to gauge how far the caller was from the cellular tower. In time, law enforcement got used to having access to that information. For anyone who's watched TV series like 24 or movies like Enemy of the State, the ability to track a suspect in real time based on cell phone data seems to be almost limitless.
In your phone was a GPS sat tracker. Pulses at 24 gigahertz.
I don't know what that means.
You speak English?
Obviously not that well.
You're kind of a jerk, aren't you? It means the NSA can read the time off your wristwatch.
Congress's last attempt to rein in the government's power to track your calls was with the 1994 Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, or CALEA. It set a clear standard for obtaining data about past cell phone calls, calls that might reveal where you were last week, but it doesn't address real-time calls that reveal where you are right now. Because CALEA skipped over real-time information, it's become a legal thicket. So much so that Al Ghadari, a Seattle lawyer who's been litigating cell phone cases since the early 90s, predicts that soon Congress will weigh in again, because both privacy rights advocates and law enforcement know all too well the secrets cell phones can reveal.
Today, law enforcement simply identifies the phone, serves the right kind of order, and the carrier regularly delivers the cell tower information. That's the built-in capability. There still is the ability to get much more granular, the enemy of the state kind of tracking, where when a phone registers regularly on a network every few minutes, you can look at the time it takes for that signal to arrive at the tower and literally triangulate the precise location for where that user may be found.
Now, you mentioned different kind of orders that police come knock you on the phone company's door carrying. I guess the most common is, where is such and such a phone right now? But there's a couple other things that police can ask for. The historical data of where a phone has been, and also using behavioral extrapolation, they can actually figure out where you're apt to be next, or patterns of your traveling. Are there different levels of court order required for different levels of information from the phone carriers?
The answer is yes and maybe. Yes, for the historical records, where we know today that an independent judge must look at a request and approve it based on specific and articulable facts that the information is relevant to an investigation. Now, that's not the probable cause standard people are used to hearing about when you talk about getting a search warrant. Then for what I would describe as real-time, where are you right now information, there's an ongoing debate. Several magistrates and judges at the federal level have said that they believe that information requires a probable cause search warrant to obtain. And indeed, magistrates have rejected requests for location tracking information on the lower standard.
Of course, law enforcement always comes to the legislature and says, we need these tools. They usually invoke terrorism. But is there any evidence that the police are being insufficiently judicious in the number of court orders they're seeking?
There is no question that we want them to have the tools and to use them when they need them. The problem is there's no transparency in when it is used today. Neither Congress nor the American public know how many such orders have been requested. They aren't reported. We have seen abuse. I often talk about one instance where a local sheriff ordered the pinging of a phone. Is it on and where is it? Over the course of a 12-hour period because his daughter hadn't come home from a date. But when you're presented with an emergency request, you don't look behind the government's request. So on average today, we're seeing probably on order of a couple hundred requests a week for emergency location tracking.
One of the quirks of cell phone tracking is that it's not quite a wiretap because nobody's listening into you, and it's not quite ordinary surveillance like a stakeout or cops following you around town. I wonder if, as is usually the case, law enforcement and the privacy hawks are on completely different pages on the law around cell phone tracking, or whether there is to some degree an overlap, a meeting of the minds.
No, I think they are in completely different places. The privacy groups think it has so many things that you don't even think about when you talk about location, like the right to travel, the right to do that without the government knowing where you're going or predicting where you're going. Your First Amendment rights, since your location might be tracked when you're in the midst of a protest. So the attributes of location and the ability to misuse them, the privacy groups believe that it should be subject to the very highest level of scrutiny. The government would like to have this as they would calling records on the lowest threshold of a mere subpoena. They would prefer to not have the hurdle of judicial oversight for it, if possible.
And the phone companies, for their part, I'm assuming just want to be told what to do, and they don't care what the law is just so long as it's straightforward.
They want certainty. They don't want to be overwhelmed with requests that are frivolous, and they don't want people to turn their phones off. So the notion of having it tracked easily and often by anyone anywhere really goes to the heart of the business model, which is to keep your phone on and answer it when it rings.
All right. Al, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Al Ghadari is a partner with the Seattle law firm Perkins Coie.
A few months ago, Doug Gollin, the editor-in-chief of Elite Traveler magazine, written for people who own private jets, wrote a letter to his readers. Doug writes these letters every month, but this one seemed to hit a nerve. Harper's Magazine reprinted it, and bloggers discussed it. The letter begins, quote, "As we enter 2009, it is amazing to see how the general media has tried to shame wealthy individuals into not spending. The fact of the matter is, the economic slump was not caused by the wealthy. It was caused by aspirational consumers who took out bigger mortgages than they could handle, leased cars they couldn't afford, and took vacations they shouldn't have. Should a person with a net worth of, say, $100 million have scaled back his or her holiday party because of the times? If we want to speak about getting the economy going again, the answer is no." He continues, "I do hope you continue to do the things that provide you the enjoyment that you've earned and your financial wherewithal supports. There are quite a few people depending on it. With best wishes for an Elite 2009, all the best, Doug Gollin."
Gollin's letter suggested that the rich have a bit of a PR problem. When we called him in Acapulco, where he is naturally on business, he told us he wrote it in response to the outrage surrounding a multi-million-dollar birthday party thrown by Stephen Schwartzman, a New York City businessman and investor.
If you started to say, where did that $2 or $3 million for that party go? Well, you know, some of it went to the florist who employs people and had to furnish all of the table settings and the flowers. Obviously, money was spent on a caterer, and that caterer probably for that evening had to hire additional people, busboys, waiters, bartenders, you know, the people who clean up after a party for 500 or 600 of your favorite friends. And so part of the motivation for writing this was understanding the importance that our readers hold for the economy. And my message was really simple. If you want to do it, you're entitled to do it. By all means, do it, because you're going to help the economy more than by keeping the money in the bank.
So you're a populist.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, or not. Did it occur to you that people would read your piece as just tone deaf to the misery and despair of, you know, ordinary people who are in extremis in these difficult economic times?
I love when people talk about people being tone deaf, because I would turn it right around. What's better for that caterer in Newark, New Jersey, to have someone throw in the party or to tell their people, we have no business this week, I can't pay you? In terms of having the right message, I think my message is maybe more on target than a lot of the stuff that's being blabbed about on these nightly cable programs.
Tell me about the audience for Elite Traveler.
650,000 readers. The magazine comes out bi-monthly. And if you want an average household income, it's $5.3 million. Main distribution is aboard private jets and also some of the big yachts in the summer in the Mediterranean, in the winter in the Caribbean.
When your readership encounters a television show like, for example, Real Housewives of Orange County or Real Housewives of New York or of Atlanta or any of the places that these freaks reside,
right?
Are they appalled? Are they themselves fascinated, or are they, you know, is there chagrin over the fact that they're somehow being caricatured along with the rest of the cartoon characters that populate these shows?
Well, that's a good question. I would say most of the people on those shows obviously don't represent our readership, because they're more at that aspirational level, and they're not people who are at the level in terms of wealth where they're flying by private jet.
Okay, so the hoi polloi have always had a kind of love-hate relationship with the rich. And at a time like this, I suppose the resentment tends to spike.
I think, you know, seeing the wealthy on their yachts and their jets was generally tolerable when they were also able to dip their toe in the water. But obviously we're in an economic crisis right now, and many of them with their mortgages in their own homes, they're underwater, car payments and things like that. They are having to make cutbacks in their own lifestyle. And, you know, it's a little bit maybe of envy that they see other people who are financially so well off that they don't have to change the way they live.
So do you have any other advice for the fundamental PR problem in 2009 of having more money than you know what to do with?
Unfortunately, it starts to a degree in Washington, D.C., where you have elected officials whose number one job is to get reelected. And certainly trying to explain to the general public the importance of rich people is probably not what you would call a great campaign platform. So, you know, it's a challenging time, I do believe, for our readership. But there's a good PR person out there that's got an idea. Put them in touch with me.
All right. Doug, thank you so much.
Bob, it was a real pleasure. And again, thank you and pleasure to talk to you.
Doug Gotlin is president and editor-in-chief of Elite Traveler magazine. Stephen Colbert of Comedy Central's Colbert Report plays the character of a narcissistic right-wing blowhard. A couple of weeks ago, when the National Organization for Marriage put out an ad warning of a looming storm of gay marriage, Colbert responded with an ad of his own.
There's a storm gathering.
A giant gay storm.
Did you know that if all 50 states approve gay marriage, straight marriage becomes illegal?
Yes, I heard that somewhere.
But there is hope. Join the Colbert Coalition, a rainbow of proud people coming together in a commercial. Join us.
As usual, Colbert wields satire like a blunt instrument. Or does he? National Organization for Marriage President Maggie Gallagher responded to the segment by writing, quote, "I've always thought Stephen Colbert was a double agent, pretending to be a conservative to pull one over Hollywood. Now I'm sure." Ohio State University's Heather Lamar is co-author of a study that actually found most conservatives do take Colbert's fake politics at face value.
You might watch that and you might think that's hilarious. He's making fun of conservatives. Look how funny that is, which is what we found for liberals. However, if you're conservative, you might look at that and say, that's hilarious. He's using comedy to expose flaws or holes in liberal thinking. So both sides basically see what they want to see.
But you haven't found that conservatives watching the show are too stupid to figure out that they're being made fun of.
Right. This has been misinterpreted widely, actually, in the press to date. There is no question in anyone's mind, according to our results, that conservatives, in fact, do understand that it's satire. What's going on here is that even though conservatives understand he's parroting a conservative, they believe he's truly targeting liberal thinking.
What I haven't seen much of is conservatives using Colbert-style satire to poke fun at liberals. Is there such an animal out there?
Well, I haven't found one yet. Most conservatives who use satire, such as talk radio show hosts Glenn Beck, sometimes Rush Limbaugh, the problem is we already know as viewers where they stand. It doesn't work the same. So until we find somebody who remains in character, remains vague, remains ambiguous on and off camera, it will be very difficult to test these hypotheses in running in the opposite direction.
So you mean it's on a technicality, the fact that he refuses to break character is what makes him a perfect petri dish specimen for your research?
Yes, but I think Stephen Colbert wouldn't call that a technicality. I think he would probably say that's a stroke of genius. I think this boils down to what the goal of the humorist is. Some people use satire as a means to make political statements. Other people use satire simply to entertain their audience. If Stephen Colbert's goal is simply to entertain his audience, he's extremely brilliant. He's the big tent entertainer. He's found a way to include all groups from all stripes. They can cast upon him anything they wish to see in his humor and interpret it for themselves as always making fun of someone else.
In your research, you did identify one difference between conservatives and liberals and how they process Colbert, a result that has not found its way into your officially published study. Can you give me a sneak peek into what that's all about?
Sure. Something that is being put out in a follow-up study is one interesting difference we did find is that the more conservative someone reported themselves to be, the more they also reported Stephen Colbert to be a credible and excellent source for political information. When we're talking about just enjoyment or humor, we don't find differences. But when we get down to sort of the brass tacks of, do you use Stephen Colbert to get political information? And when he says something political, do you find it credible and reliable? Conservatives are more likely to say yes.
But doesn't that fly in the face of the rest of your findings? Doesn't that suggest that, as much of the press has misreported your study, that right-wingers are more likely to be really, really obtuse?
Well, actually, I would say it confirms our study. I guess my best analogy would be when somebody makes some caustic or dry humor joke that could be hurtful to someone else, and at the end they polish it off with a smile and, oh, I'm just kidding. And that leaves the victim of that joke and everyone else who listened to the joke in the room wondering, well, were they really kidding or was there some hidden meaning there? Were they trying to convey a message and they just used humor to do it? That is what conservatives believe is going on with Colbert. And because of that, it prompts them to do information seeking, discussion, and more thinking about the topics he brings up. And it also allows them to perceive him as being a credible source for political information.
Heather Lamar is a doctoral candidate at Ohio State and has just accepted a job as assistant professor at the University of Minnesota. Heather, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Cara Gianfrido and Ethan Scheel, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science. Neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.